From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Bill Littlefield. This is Only a Game. Barbaro's breakdown in last year's Preakness and the January euthanization of the 2006 Derby winner has many in the horse racing industry refocused on making racing safer for thoroughbreds. Some tracks in Kentucky, California, Canada, and the UK have made the switch to a synthetic surface called Polytrack, which is designed to prevent catastrophic injuries. But Polytrack has received mixed reviews from horsemen and women. Kathleen Adams of member station WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, reports.
Six days before the Kentucky Derby, as barn workers rake the shed row, thoroughbred trainer Todd Pletcher takes a break from studying race conditions to meet with the media. Pletcher is horse racing's 2006 Trainer of the Year. And as of last Sunday, he had five prospects vying for the coveted Garland of Roses. But on that day, four of his Derby hopefuls, Cowtown Cat, Scat Daddy, Circular Key, and Any Given Saturday, are nowhere near Churchill Downs. Instead, the quartet is training some 77 miles east of Louisville.
Just felt like, you know, with the spring weather being sometimes unsettled, we could come to Keeneland, we could train on the Polytrack and not have to worry about rain or any of the other factors that might uproot your schedule.
Polytrack is a mixture of sand, synthetic fibers, and recycled rubber combined and coated with a microcrystalline wax that allows water to flow through it to a specially designed drainage system. Its proponents say it provides horses with a safer and more consistent running surface than typical dirt racetracks. And that, says Keeneland's racing director Rogers Beasley, is why 14 of the possible 20 Derby entrants were stabled at the Lexington racetrack a week prior to the Kentucky Derby.
It's the safety of the horse, safety, safety, safety. That's what we're interested in. That's what every racetrack's interested in. And we want to show that to the people that love our sport and to attract new fans.
Until her retirement late last week, Dr. Nancy Davis was chief state veterinarian for the Kentucky Horse Racing Authority and worked all five of the state's racetracks, two of which have the synthetic surface.
Polytrack has really been the biggest plus that I've seen for thoroughbred racing in the 33 years that I've been on the racetrack. It's made a surface that it's forgiving enough to the horse that it doesn't cause the injuries we were seeing on dirt.
On a warm spring morning, thoroughbreds exercise at Turfway Park in Florence, Kentucky. The facility was the first North American racetrack to install Polytrack. Even as three horses work in company, the thunder of hooves is noticeably absent. Pick up a handful of Polytrack, and pieces of old tires and remnants of red and green carpeting are revealed. It is this material Davis credits with decreasing the number of catastrophic breakdowns at Turfway Park, where in 2005 there were 13 fatalities during the first 2 months of the year.
And then in the what we call winter meet, which was January, February, March, and a week of April of 06, that first year we didn't have any catastrophic injuries at all. It was wonderful. It was remarkable. We went a month without even picking up a cut or anything. It was great.
But while there were no fatal injuries in early 2006, horsemen at Turfway started to report other problems. They complained about the Polytrack surface balling up, collecting in hooves and shoes, and possibly causing the horse's legs to strike the ground unevenly. Terry Smith is an assistant to Kentucky trainer Greg Foley.
It wears and tears on their ankles and their joints, actually, you know, because they're not putting their foot down. They're rolling, you know, all over. So we tried, you know, spraying stuff in their feet and that, but a lot of times it was that bad we just didn't go out there. You know, just kept them in the barn.
Turfway Park President Bob Elliston says the racetrack worked closely with trainers and jockeys to correct the problem. But harsh winter weather made it difficult to maintain the synthetic surface. But Elliston says that dealing with maintenance problems is part of the learning curve, and he remains a strong proponent. He says since installing the surface, the track's maintenance costs have dropped by 60% and field sizes have increased. Elliston adds horsemen have endorsed Polytrack by opting to train their Derby contenders on it.
Typically what happens to these horses along the way are these nicks and pings. We rarely see the best horses have career-ending injuries along the Derby trail, but it just knocks them off training and it knocks them off that rigid schedule that you have to maintain to deliver them in the optimum position that first Saturday in May.
For Only a Game, I'm Kathleen Adams in Florence, Kentucky.
Let's now turn our attention to talking shrubs and literature. The story of Moses on Mount Sinai includes one example of same, as does the tale of Cyrano de Bergerac, in which the hero, hidden by a bush, rhapsodizes to his beloved Roxanne. Commentator Alyssa Eli offers another.
We were bird watching, bird listening, really. It's a little like visiting the UN when you speak only English and there are no translators. The interpretive possibilities approach infinity. We had our bird books in one hand and in the other unfolded maps of the sanctuary. If our binoculars weren't dangling around our necks, we would have had to carry them in our teeth. It takes a lot of hands to listen to birds. Near the end of a path, we found a thicket of bushes someone had told us about, a location known for particularly elusive birds. The foliage was dense and lush, and feeders were grouped all around it. We raised our binoculars. We were searching for the fox sparrow. For a long time, we stood in silence, planted in front of the bushes. Our shoes turned to roots, buds pushed out of our fingertips. A crow flew by, a car started up in the distance. Nothing else moved except our four eyes. We were utterly alone. Finally, my friend shook her head. "No one's here," she said, in a normal tone. She started to walk past the thicket back to the main path. I was folding up my map when a large shrub on my right shook itself slightly and spoke. "You girls find anything?" it said. The long end of a camera lens was poking out from under filmy military camouflage, just the color of brush, and under that a pair of unmoving boots blended perfectly with the earth. My friend didn't miss a beat. "No, not much," she said. "How about you?" It was as if she held conversations with Flora all the time. "Grackles," said the bush. It took two steps to the left, and a nose emerged from under the camouflage. "Gonna give up for today. Better luck tomorrow." "That's right," my friend said. The moment was oracular. When you think you're alone and a bush speaks to you, never mind the birds, you must listen to it utterly. If you are fortunate and have been standing in the right place, it will tell you what you've been hoping to hear. There will be better luck tomorrow.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist in Massachusetts. Much has been made recently about the fact that African American players comprise just 8% of Major League Baseball rosters, but in college baseball, that number is even lower. At last year's NCAA Division I College World Series between Oregon State and North Carolina, just 2% of the players were black. Even universities with a historical mission to educate black students are dealing with a lack of modern African-American baseball players, and no one is quite sure what to do about it. Dave DeWitt reports from Durham, North Carolina.
It's the first pitch of a recent game between North Carolina Central University and St. Augustine's College. NC Central's Robert Landis rears back and throws a high, tight fastball to Ontario Bell. He swings at the pitch and pops it straight up into the air. Three defensive players converge, no one calls for it, and the ball falls to the grass just as Bell pulls into second base. It's unlikely any of these Division II college players will ever compete in a major league park or play professional baseball at any level. But for every error these players make, they also show their skill with a spectacular catch in the outfield or their joy for the game by sprinting on and off the field in between innings. These players clearly love to play. But for some, including NC Central center fielder Oliver Jenkins, it's been a struggle to stay with a game that many other black players abandon as kids.
So I was the only black guy on my high school team. One thing I know for myself, that I was around it, so that made me enjoy it more. and then not really seeing a lot of black guys play, it kind of stray away, and a lot of people, idols, would be from football or basketball, and that, you know, towards them for basketball or football.
Hey, let's go right here, defense.
A quick glance at the NC Central team in the field reveals that only a little more than half of the players are black. This is at a university where over 90% of the undergraduate student population is African American. Henry White is the NC Central coach. He's been around baseball at historically black colleges for over 30 years. He hears all the time from parents and kids that the game itself is the problem.
It's slow. They don't understand that there's that baseball is a thinking game. They don't see that aspect of it. They see basketball, constant moving, constant playing, track, he's constantly doing something, football the same, and you got more fan support. So they don't see the what I call the game within the game.
Tyrell Godwin agrees. He was one of the country's best baseball players coming out of high school 10 years ago and is now an outfielder for the Louisville Bats, the AAA affiliate of the Cincinnati Reds. But he was often recognized more for his relatively moderate success as a football player in his small hometown of Elizabeth City, North Carolina.
As a whole, the black community, we glamorize the other sports more. In high school sports, people tend to follow basketball and football more because it's like it's more of a social event. People who follow baseball are really fans.
Godwin was selected in the first round of the 1997 baseball draft by the Yankees, but turned down New York's $2 million signing bonus to attend North Carolina on an academic scholarship, where he played baseball and football. And once there, the lack of black athletes in baseball became even more apparent.
Yeah, it was kind of discouraging at times to see as few black players playing baseball as there were, especially considering when me playing football and then when I go in a football locker room full of other black players.
But it's more than just a lack of interest that keeps African-American kids from playing baseball in college. Aaron Fitt covers NCAA baseball for Baseball America magazine. He says the emphasis placed on summer traveling teams in youth baseball has limited opportunities for kids from low-income families. And too often, that means kids of color.
It's something that's kind of seen as maybe a country club sport a little bit. It takes money to participate in these summer leagues, to go to these showcases, these kind of things to get exposure. And a lot of times, you know, it's the suburban kids, the white kids who get to do that stuff.
Which then leads to the white kids getting the baseball scholarships. But that's only a part of the problem. According to Fitt, there's not a lot of baseball scholarships for anyone.
Well, because baseball only has 11.7 scholarships to divvy up among its entire roster, very few players are on full scholarships. Some kids will be on half scholarships. Some kids will only get a book scholarship. You know, they'll get their books paid for, and that's it. But most kids don't have a lot of aid in baseball, and so a lot of them have to pay their own way.
The NCAA, like Major League Baseball, is considering ways to increase minority participation levels. One of the proposals is an increase in scholarships. And while that may help some schools diversify their rosters, it may affect the historically black schools in a different way. North Carolina Central is moving to Division I next year, and as Coach Henry White recruits better players, he's not concerned with race as much as talent and commitment. Sitting in the dugout between the two games in a doubleheader, he looks into the future. And what he sees is a very different team than the ones he's coached in the past.
That's probably the biggest major jump. I've seen major influence has been the Latino and Hispanic population in baseball of today, especially on the college level. Bethune-Cookman, Maryland Eastern Shores, all of them, you know, have a lot of Hispanics, Latino ball players.
And is that a good thing for HBCU baseball in particular?
Right now it is, because that's where you find kids who want to go to school, who are going to make the academic effort, the whole nine yards.
The irony, White says, is if baseball scholarship money does increase, so will the competition. So it's unclear what effect, if any, that will have on the number of black players who choose baseball in the future. For Only a Game, I'm Dave DeWitt in Durham, North Carolina.
Joining me now to discuss the week's news is Mr. NASCAR himself, the redoubtable Charles P. Pierce, Esquire. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
He appears to be prepared. On Thursday,
Wilbur.
Let's get to something else first. On Thursday, the Golden State Warriors, number 8 seed in the NBA's Western Conference, eliminated the number 1 seed from those playoffs. How is it that everyone seems to be in shock over the Mavericks' first-round loss, despite the fact that many predicted it?
Well, there was some talk that the Warriors' 3-0 record
over Dallas in the regular season was a fluke because of this circumstance and that circumstance, and somebody was hurt, and Dallas didn't start real well this year. You know what? The Dallas Mavericks, owned by the world's smartest human, just ask him, Mark Cuban, are now 2-8 in their last 10 playoff games. And I think it's about time for Mark to just shut up and start building a basketball team that can win him a championship after spending all the money on this basketball team that can't.
Well, you mentioned Mark Cuban, but will any NBA player have a tougher offseason than Dirk Nowitzki?
No, he actually was obviously making a late run for MVP. He didn't seem to be there in the game they needed him at. He came out with some comments afterwards where it really sounded kind of elegiac, like he realizes that somehow he's feeling like his window on his career is closed. It's very, very strange.
This week, the New York Times reported that an academic study had demonstrated that white officials in the NBA call fouls at a greater rate against black players than they do against white players. What's your take on this?
I think we should wait and see the data after it's peer-reviewed before we all leap to condemn this thing as the NBA and its kept press have. This is a serious study done by a bunch of guys who are otherwise probably pretty boring, and they know what they're doing, and they're going to submit it to a panel of guys who are probably even more boring and know even better what they're doing. So until that comes out, I think we should not take seriously the NBA study, which began in March or whatever it is. It says, no, you're wrong.
Commissioner Stern apparently thinks there could be what he called this week, quote, an NBA of China. Is this a euphemism for a giant NBA ATM in China?
I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, if you know, again, it's thinking not only outside the box, but a couple of steps ahead of what's probably logistically possible. But I don't have any illusions that someday there will be a Major League Baseball franchise league in Japan or in the Caribbean somewhere, possibly in Havana after, you know, my golden dream after Fidel finally kicks, or an NBA professional league in China.
The formerly mighty Ducks of Anaheim of Los Angeles truly are mighty. They are in the NHL's Western Conference Finals. Will L.A., Anaheim of L.A. or whatever it is, finally succumb to hockey madness?
Well, they were never L.A., were they? They were always the mighty Ducks of Anaheim or the Anaheim Ducks of Anaheim or the Angels of the – or not the Angels of Anaheim, mighty Ducks up the street from Wadi Duda. But, yeah, they're certainly better than the Vancouver Canucks. They win 4-1. They win two overtimes. They clinched the series. Rob Niedermeyer, the Niedermeyer brothers, actually had a terrific series. Jean-Sebastien Jaguar, the goalie, is 10-1 in the playoffs. And once again, you're going to wind up with a Stanley Cup for the balance of the offseason in a very strange place.
Charlie, we've talked about head injuries suffered by National Football League players before. This week, Commissioner Goodell announced that in June he will convene a meeting of medical personnel from all the teams required attendance to discuss the problem. Is this a significant development?
This is not just another study committee, which the NFL has done several times in the past, largely to prevent them from actually doing anything substantive on the problem. All the teams have to send their doctors and the trainers. The doctors and the trainers by being invited to this meeting by themselves, are sort of being enlisted by the league rather than the teams they work for, which would be a big step forward.
In post-draft news, the New England Patriots acquired Randy Moss last Sunday, a move made possible when Pats quarterback Tom Brady agreed to restructure his contract. So talk to me of sacrifice and math.
Well, I'm trying to do the math in my head. Basically, Tom Brady pushed some money he was owed back down the line a little bit so they could afford to bring Randy Moss in. What is really, absent Randy Moss's lengthy rap sheet, a very, very sweet deal for the New England Patriots. He was going to make $9.75 million from the Raiders this year. Once the trade was made, Moss tore up that contract and signed a one-year, $3 million deal that could only go up to five if he meets every incentive. One of the incentives, of course, is number of catches, which he won't get because of the way the Patriots have structured their offense. Leaving aside the moral outrage and the sudden, you know, scales falling from the eyes of people that Bob Kraft isn't really running the New England Patriots as kind of public moral witness, this was a great football move.
If you were Joe Torre, would you have been sending out your resume this week?
Well, why? Because your owner has said he backs you thoroughly in everything you do? The dreaded vote of confidence.
The dreaded vote of confidence has been issued.
When the crown jewel of your farm system, Philip Hughes, a pitcher, is pitching a no-hitter in the seventh inning and celebrates that by blowing out a hamstring. Gentlemen, it's not your year, okay? It's going to be a lovely summer. Enjoy the sunshine. Enjoy the nice trips to the West Coast. But you're not going to do anything. I think this is Joe Torre's swan song in New York. I hope he's allowed to manage out the year.
I'm sure you're proud of your status as our Mr. NASCAR. Was your pride diminished this week as a result of some foolish fan behavior at the Talladega Super Speedway?
Yeah, they were throwing beer cans at the winner after Jeff Gordon won the race. This is sort of embarrassing to those of us who have a deep love and respect for NASCAR, as you know. They found 14 of the miscreants. They're going to ban them, apparently, forever from the Talladega Super Speedway. It's probably a good thing. It really was kind of embarrassing if you're pitching your sport to a national audience.
It's Derby Day,
it
Charlie,
is.
And Jenny Reese is on the record with her pick, so what's yours?
My pick, actually, is a horse that had a disappointing run in the Wood Memorial, but I think is better than that, and is going off at 12-1, a horse called Any Given Saturday, so I'm going to give him this Saturday.
I found a website this week that's inviting us to bet on the color of Her Majesty's hat when she arrives at Churchill Downs. Do you like white slash silver at 5-2?
No, actually, I think 6-1 on green is a great price, actually, because green is the queen's color.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. And how he knew that the queen's color was green, I have no idea, but thank you, Charlie.
Wouldn't it be great if she had one of those hats with the two beer cans in it?
Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.